Last Sunday, we were in Psalm 130 as we are working our way through the Psalms of Ascent this summer. Last week, we looked at this a prayer that is really focused on confession, and we talked about that prayer of confession that has the promise of forgiveness that we have been singing about this morning, that forgiveness that is available from God through His Son, Jesus Christ. Just to give you a little glimpse forward, our plan is to finish this series on the Psalms by the end of the month of August, and the beginning in September, we will be moving into a series on the Gospel of Mark, and we'll have some breaks along the way, but that will be in Mark for a while. And so if you want to spend some time preparing for that, you can go ahead and read ahead in Mark's Gospel. Today, we're going to move on to Psalm 131 and examine an attitude that we have been talking a little bit about already this morning, perhaps one of the most important attitudes for followers of Christ to develop, and also perhaps one of the most difficult. So if you have your Bibles, I want to start by reading that short psalm. I'm going to be reading from the old NIV. We read it earlier from the ESV, and there's some intentionality. You'll understand in a little bit why we wanted you to hear both of those versions this morning. It says, beginning in verse 1, "My heart is not proud, O Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. But I have stilled and quieted my soul, like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child is my soul within me. O Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forevermore." Probably all of you at some point have had that experience of pulling up to a stoplight, and you're sitting there waiting for the light to turn green, and a car or some other vehicle pulls up next to you, and you hear this dum dum. Boom, boom, really loud, right? You just kind of just, you can hear their stereo better than you can hear the radio in your own vehicle, right? We've all experienced that. I had a friend in high school who was really into car stereos, and he had this little bitty car with a really big stereo, and you could sit in the back seat, and I remember when he'd turn that thing up, you know, like your pant legs would vibrate with the bass. It was just incredible. But I had no idea how far that hobby could go. Until I read an article recently about decibel drag racing. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of this, but apparently there are competitions to see whose stereo can measure the most decibels. The world record set just a couple of years ago was over 183 decibels. Now, to put that into perspective, A jetliner, 747, taking off, only produces about 140 decibels. Now, here's the irony of it. Most of the vehicles, in fact, virtually all of the vehicles that enter these contests are undrivable. They weigh over 10,000 pounds, and there's no spot for a driver because they've taken everything out to put batteries in to power their stereos. Not only that, but it gets even more bizarre because most of these stereos don't play music. They're designed to play just a single frequency at a very high level of sound. And so that is all of the money and all of the time spent to produce a single note at a very loud level. When I read the article, I think he concluded it well, the author. He said the following: "Everybody wants to be the king of a hill, but the number of aspiring kings dwarfs the number of available hills. So in this country, we've built more hills." But we do, as human beings, seem to have this innate desire to outdo our neighbor, right? We have this sort of innate desire to be the best, to rise above and to think of ourselves above those around us, to, you know, keep up with or keep ahead of the Joneses, so to speak. Psalm 131 tries to help us to see that there is a better way to live. that there is a better way to live than the pursuit of personal glory, than trying to be that king of the hill. And the author of the psalm should know, because David was literally the king of the hill. But along the way, he had learned some important lessons, which he shares with us. Lessons about pride and ambition versus humility and contentment. You see, pride focuses on myself. Pride is the pursuit of my desires. Pride is trying to elevate myself above others. And by its very nature, it takes my focus off of God. It takes my focus off of the needs of other people and places it squarely on me. And pride breeds discontent. Humility, on the other hand, puts our focus back on God. Humility takes our focus off of myself, allows me to focus on God, allows me to focus on other people, and brings a restful contentment to life. Pride quickly takes our focus off of the Lord, whereas humility allows us to have a heart that pursues Him. Well, even though the term for humility is not used in this psalm, these verses, and especially verse 1, do a great job of describing it for us. And so I want to begin by looking at this example of humility, a humble example, as is described here in the first verse of this psalm. David begins, "My heart is not proud, O Lord." Now, earlier, we read from the ESV this same verse, and you may remember it said in that version, "My heart is not lifted up." And that's actually a more literal translation of the word that the NIV translates as proud. It's saying, "My heart is not lifted up," or "I am not elevating myself above those around me. I'm not thinking of myself in a way that is superior to those that are around me in my proximity." Romans chapter 12, verse 3, Paul says something very similar when he says, "Not to think more highly of yourself than you ought." It's the same idea that is being communicated here in the first part of verse 1. Humility begins then with a right attitude about myself in relationship to other people, and a right attitude about myself in relationship to God. That I am not trying to elevate my heart or myself above God and others. Now, remember who's writing this psalm. As we go through this, remember this is David, who is a king, saying, "My heart is not lifted up." If anybody had reason to have an elevated heart, it would be the king, right? Because everybody around you is trying to please you. Whatever you say is what happens, and you have that kind of authority over the nation. And yet David is saying, as he looks at his servants waiting on him, at others doing his bidding, "My heart is not lifted up." That seems very different than what our normal tendency as human beings is. For evidence of that, you don't need to look very far, right? It's amazing to me how in professional sports, and especially I think of professional football, how the celebration has taken over the game, right? I mean, it used to be if somebody scored a touchdown, they might celebrate, you know, in the end zone. Or if somebody made a great play and there was an interception or a fumble recovery that turned the game, there might be a celebration. But man, if you watch a professional football game now, I mean, every tackle is celebrated. You know, every two-yard gain, the guy gets up and you would think that he just cured cancer. It's incredible the celebrations that we have, but that is our nature. All of us as human beings, we want to boast. We want to hold it over those around us when we do well. We want to elevate or to lift up our hearts. David continues, My heart is not proud, O Lord. My eyes are not haughty. Now again, when we read that earlier, I think it said something like, my eyes are not elevated. Because the two words used in these first two phrases both have the same meaning. They're different words, but they both have the same meaning, this idea of being lifted up or being elevated. And so in this second phrase, when David talks about his eyes, he's saying, my eyes are also not lifted up. It'd be similar to saying, as we might today, I don't look down on other people, right? I'm not looking down on those around me. Now, as I was reading this week, when you see in the Psalms or Proverbs these kind of parallelisms where you have the same thing basically kind of stated twice, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not lifted up, it's sometimes worth kind of trying to figure out, is there some nuance to what's being said, or is it just meant to say the same thing twice? And so I was kind of looking at these two words to see if there was some kind of nuance there, and wasn't getting very far, so I called a local Hebrew scholar that most of you probably know, and kind of consulted with him a little bit. And one interesting thing about the second word that David uses when he's talking about my eyes are not lifted up, is that it is spelled the same, that the three consonants, and Hebrew words are just three consonants. There are no vowels. And so this word has another word that's spelled with those same three consonants. It basically be like a homonym, although the vowel, if you insert the vowel sounds, it's not. But it would be, as you looked at it written, it could be either word. And the Sether word means to deceive, which is an interesting thing that David chooses as he's talking about my eyes being lifted up, that he chooses this word, which also has a second word that means deceive. It brings to mind Galatians 6:3, where Paul says, if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. That pride has this way of deceiving us. Pride has this way of causing us to not see the world around us the way that we should, to not see ourselves in relationship to others in the way that we should. And then David continues, he says, then I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. Now that last phrase is again a rather interesting one when you stop and consider the author. Because here is a king who rules over a nation whose decisions on a daily basis affect thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of other people. And he says, I do not concern myself with great matters. I don't know about you, but when I think of great matters, I'm thinking of the decisions of leaders of nations, right? I mean, on a day-by-day basis, it would seem that David has to concern himself with great matters. So what is he trying to say? What is it that David is trying to communicate? And I think there's a couple of things that are possible. One of those is that David may be, in a sense, guarding against criticism from those who look at David's life and say that here is an ambitious person who sought to elevate himself. Because remember, David was a shepherd who became the king. Saul was king. Jonathan, everybody expected, probably would be king after Saul. But God anoints David, and David eventually becomes king. However, David is pointing out that it is not because he was aspiring to matters too wonderful, to greatness, but rather it was God who brought him to the place that he is. That's one possibility, but I think the other possibility, which is to me probably where David is coming at this as already the king, is that a kind of wisdom and perspective on his role that perhaps, if you've never been in that kind of position, would be difficult to understand. Albert Einstein once said, the more I learn, the more I realize how much I do not know. And I think David, as king, where everybody else would say, he has the power, he has the control, he has all of this greatness about him, says, no, no, I'm not the one in control. I'm not the one who has the power. I'm not the one who is in charge and who governs this nation. David is recognizing his own limitation. David is recognizing his own weakness and his need for the one who genuinely has control. So, humility is exemplified in this first verse by one who has a level heart, whose heart is not elevated, by one who has level eyes, whose eyes are not lifted up and looking down on those around them. And then finally, by one who has level thinking, who has a right perspective on their role in this world, that we are just players in the story that God is writing. As we move into verse 2 then, we begin to see some important benefits to the life of one who is humble. Let's look at two humble results of this kind of living. Verse 2 begins, "But I have stilled and quieted my soul." So although my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not lifted up, and I do not concern myself with matters too great or too wonderful for me, however, I have stilled and quieted my soul. So the result of verse 1 is this stillness, this quietness of soul. You see, there is a truth that the desire for greatness, the pride that pushes us to try to become better than those around us, in whatever pursuit that may be, in whatever way that may be, that pride does not and cannot satisfy. One of two things will take place. Either we will attain that which we are striving for and come up realizing that it doesn't satisfy and that my life is empty. Or we will strive and strive and strive and never reach the place that we desire. Either way, it breeds discontent. That king of the hill desire, it may lead to some accomplishment, but it will always lead to discontent and misery. This past year, the run of the phenomenon, the cultural phenomenon, American Idol, ended this past spring. And it was an interesting... Yeah, it's an interesting kind of cultural thing to watch. I'll say it that way. But in addition, because in addition to the live show where there was actually the competition, they always before would have and they would show the taped tryouts. And I don't know if you ever watched any of those episodes with the taped tryouts, but it was remarkable because you had people that would try out for this singing competition who could not sing. I mean, just they could sing, but not on pitch, not in any sort of resemblance of a melody. Now, some of those were no doubt just there to get their 15 minutes of fame. But there were others that seemed to genuinely believe that this was what they were supposed to do in life. Somewhere along the line had bought into the idea that you can just be whatever you want to be, whether the talent and the ability is there or not. And they would be angry when they were told that they weren't good enough to be on the show. There would be, I mean, bitterness and so forth just directed at the judges and anybody else who was listening. And it comes back to this pride, this belief that whatever I set my mind to, I'm going to be able to accomplish. That self-dependence. You know, we try to tell our kids, and of course you want to instill in your kids this idea of setting goals and accomplishing goals, and you can do things. But the truth is this, we not all of the children in this country can become president someday. I mean, mathematically, it's not possible for everybody to become president someday. Pride leads us to discontent. Humility, by contrast, leads to quietness and a restfulness. But I have stilled and quieted my soul. Humility keeps those desires, it keeps those goals in perspective. It's not that someone who is humble cannot go on to accomplish things, but it is the person who is humble has a right perspective on those pursuits of life because they have a singular priority. They understand that these other things are not their primary purpose. David could just have easily written this psalm as a shepherd instead of as a king. And what is it then that brings this peace and this contentment? He goes on in verse 2, he says, like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child is my soul within me. Now I had to stop and read that several times to figure out how that analogy related to quietness and stillness of soul. There is immediately this image that comes to mind of a child with its mother, and certainly that is a peaceful image. But what David is saying here is something a little bit different than just sort of that restfulness of a child with its mother. What David is talking about here is a weaned child. A child that is still nursing finds when there is hunger, when there is a desire for nourishment, finds satisfaction in its mother's milk. And so if you've been around a baby that's hungry, there's a lot of noise, right? And until that nourishment is received. What David says is that his soul is like a weaned child. So a child that is no longer dependent upon that nourishment. That once what was once or at one point seemed indispensable to life now is not necessary. And in the same way, David's soul, the soul of the humble person, is weaned from those things which seemed so important, which seemed to be irreplaceable, but now are recognized as less than important, less than essential. Humility allows us to keep perspective on our goals because now we have a different motivation, a different priority. Which brings us then to the third verse in this psalm. As we look now at a shift in our priority, let's look at a humble pursuit. David declares, O Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forevermore. Put your hope in the Lord. Once again, David is the king of the nation. But here demonstrates the fullness of his understanding and his own humility as a leader. Because David is not telling his people to put their hope in him, but rather to put their hope in the one who stands behind him, the one who genuinely is protecting and supporting the nation, the only one who can make a difference in their lives. We are in the midst of an election year, and it's an interesting one, to say the least. And it's interesting because as people talk and I'm hearing conversations and people come and ask me questions, there seems to be in general a kind of malaise, a sort of almost depression in a sense among some, especially Christians, I think, as we look at the candidates from the two primary parties and there's kind of this sense of there's not a lot of hope. You know, that the options are that great. And the reason I think that's interesting and the reason I mention it here is because it is in our nature, so to speak, to want to put hope in our leaders, our human leaders, to fix things. To put hope in our governments to make our lives better. And what David is saying is to put your hope in the Lord. That even if you have a godly, humble leader, your hope should still be in the Lord. And not in humans, flesh, blood, failures that we are in our own weakness. David is not shouting, "Yes, we can." He is shouting that only God can. And so put your hope in Him. That is at the heart of humility, because it shows a shift in our priority, a shift in our thinking. That pride which leads to self-exaltation, that pride which leads to self-dependence, is now recognizing a need to depend upon the Lord and to give Him the glory. And so this psalm both begins and ends with a focus on the Lord. Interestingly, in verse 1, again in the ESV, they rightly put the "O Lord" at the beginning of verse 1, because that's really where it belongs. And so the psalm begins, "O Lord," and it ends, "O Israel, put your hope in the Lord," with a focus on where our priority, where our hope must rest. But the other interesting thing about this last verse is that not only is there a focus back on the Lord, but there's also a focus on other people. David has been talking about the results of his own humility and how it has impacted his own life, and now wants to share that with others, to share that with the nation. "O Israel, put your hope in the Lord. Come before your Lord humbly. Depend upon the Lord. And He is the one who will give you rest. He is the one who will give you a future." Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4 says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others before yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others." And so instead of this me-first mentality which pervades our culture, the Scriptures, our Savior, encourages us to put our hope in the Lord and to focus on the needs of those around us. As I said at the beginning, there's perhaps no more important attitude to cultivate for the believer than humility. David understood this. Jesus demonstrates it. Paul encourages it. Back in 1656, Richard Baxter wrote the following. Just so we know that this isn't a new problem. He says, "Oh, what a constant companion, what a tyrannical commander, what a sly and subtle insinuating enemy is this sin of pride. Is not pride the sin of devils, the firstborn of hell? Is it not that wherein Satan's image doth much consist? And is it to be tolerated in men who are so engaged against him and his kingdom as we are? The very design of the gospel is to abase us, and the work of grace is begun and carried on in humiliation. Humility is not a mere ornament of a Christian, but an essential part of the new creature. It is a contradiction in terms to be a Christian and to not be humble." He says some very important truths there. That at the very nature, at the very foundation of the gospel is the humiliation, the humility of Christ, who left the throne of heaven, who became a man, so that He could go to the cross and take the punishment for our sin. And when we come to faith in Jesus Christ, we are coming as sinners, acknowledging our need, acknowledging our hopelessness apart from Christ, putting our full dependence, our full trust on Him for our salvation, for our forgiveness, for our rescue, for a life with God that lasts for all eternity. It is a humbling place to begin. And so as we continue in that life as followers of Jesus Christ, it only makes sense that we would continue in humility and in dependence and in trust upon God, placing our hope in Him.